Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, response to Donald Trump's latest allegations about widespread voter fraud, this time in New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire, there appears on the surface to be significant irregularities with our voting system.
Also today, should government-subsidized daycare be a public right? And will Ivanka Trump convince her father to make it one? Plus, from the war in Iraq back home to Massachusetts, how one Army medic overcame drug addiction and thoughts of suicide.
So I got involved in these pickup artist classes, thinking that would save me, that would bring me out of this hole of depression.
And
you know there's a light that glows by the front door.
Massachusetts' Lori McKenna wins top honors at the Grammys. All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Starshine, always stay humble and kind.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Let's begin today with allegations of voter fraud in New Hampshire. President Donald Trump has stirred controversy again by saying that if not for widespread voter fraud, he would have won the popular vote, which Hillary Clinton carried by more than 3 million ballots. And this latest charge involves the Granite State, where Hillary Clinton won by nearly 3,000 votes last November, and Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte lost to Maggie Hassan by just 743 votes. In a meeting last Thursday with senators to talk about Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch, Trump claimed that he and Ayotte would have both won in New Hampshire if not for thousands of people who were brought in on buses from neighboring Massachusetts to vote illegally. Now, voting experts have said there's no evidence to support Trump's claim, but he won't drop it. Yesterday on ABC's This Week, George Stephanopoulos pressed Stephen Miller, a senior Trump advisor on the issue. So here's Miller.
Go to New Hampshire, talk to anybody who's worked in politics there for a long time. Everybody's aware of the problem in New Hampshire with respect to
I'm asking you
bringing
as the
in
White
voters
House senior
and with respect
hold on
to
a second. I'm asking you as the White House senior policy advisor. The president made a statement saying he was the victim of voter fraud, people being bused from Massachusetts
and
New Hampshire.
The president was.
Do you have any evidence?
Miller did not have any evidence, but he said people in New Hampshire know this is a problem. So let's turn to one of those people. Former state rep Stephen Stepanek was co-chair of Donald Trump's presidential campaign in New Hampshire, and he joins us now. Stephen, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the president says Massachusetts voters drove up to New Hampshire by the busload to vote illegally in this past election. Do you think he's right?
To a large extent, he is. We have very, very lax voter laws here.
So I want to ask you about those. I'm going to let you explain those laws, but I just want to stick with that first question that George Stephanopoulos was trying to get Miller to respond to. I mean, do we have evidence that this happened?
I believe we do.
Okay. So tell me what that is.
Well, basically, we have what is called same-day registration here in New Hampshire. We have very lax domicile laws, and I've coined the phrase, if you're in the New Hampshire state of mind, you can come up to New Hampshire and vote. And essentially what that means is you have to just state that you feel that you want to live in New Hampshire and have a domicile for a day, and you can vote in New Hampshire. Under the way the courts have interpreted our domicile laws.
But isn't there a difference between a system that might invite fraud and saying there is actual evidence that busloads of people came up?
Well, if you let me finish, I will get to that point. And that point is that in the process of doing same-day registration, you come in and you have to show identification. And we had thousands of people who showed up with Massachusetts licenses as identification. But we also had a very significant number of people who didn't have identification and didn't have any kind of evidence that they had any domicile within New Hampshire. And in those situations, what we do is we take an affidavit from those people, and in which they swear they are who they say they are, and that they are, in fact, domiciled in New Hampshire. And they give the address that they're domiciled at. And then they are given the opportunity to vote. They're not given a provisional ballot like happens in a lot of other states. They are allowed to vote, and their vote is cast. And at that point, there's no way to take it back. Now, what's happened is the Attorney General's office is then required to send out a certified letter to those addresses to make sure that those people have, in fact, live where they say they live. And we have had literally thousands of those certified letters coming back as undeliverable. Now, the Attorney General's office is so overwhelmed with the number of letters coming back that they can't investigate them.
Right. Because, as you know, you're
on the surface.
Because let me just jump in here, because as you know, your Secretary of State's office has also denied or challenged the idea of this, saying there's no evidence of thousands of fraudulent voters in New Hampshire on Election Day.
Well, that's because he hasn't investigated it to determine that. I mean, he's got thousands of certified letters from people who filled out affidavits that came back as undeliverable to addressee.
Okay.
Now, if you don't investigate that, then there's no evidence, clear-cut evidence, that there's fraud.
Right. But what do you say, finally, what do you say to people, and there are many who have studied this issue across the country. I've talked to a bunch of these people. They say there is simply no evidence of widespread voter fraud anywhere in the country. There are isolated cases, but not in the numbers that the president has claimed. And these are findings by people who have really made it their life's work to study elections. What do you say to the to this point?
All I can do is comment on New Hampshire. And in New Hampshire, there appears on the surface to be significant irregularities with our voting system. And that is one of the things that now Governor Sununu has pledged to bring forth legislation to correct. If you don't investigate irregularities, you don't find voter fraud. And that's been the case here in New Hampshire. We have not investigated, and therefore we have not found.
All right. I'm going to leave it right there. That's former New Hampshire State Rep Stephen Stepanek, who served as New Hampshire State co-chair for the Trump campaign. Stephen Stepanek, thank you very much for your time. We're very grateful.
Thank you very much.
Now, we spoke to Bill Gardner, New Hampshire's Secretary of State, about this. He told us there are lots of protections in place to guard against voter fraud. He also said in the last election cycle, less than 1/5 of 1% of voters did not have acceptable identification. So let's get some more reaction, this time from Fergus Cullen. He's the former chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party, a longtime critic of Donald Trump. He did not support him for president, and he's been tweeting up a storm. Here's what he tweeted today. I will pay $1,000 to the first person proving that even one out-of-state person took a bus from Massachusetts to any New Hampshire polling place last election day. Fergus Cullen joins us now from Manchester. It's good to have you back on Radio Boston, Fergus.
Thank you, Anthony.
So what's your reaction to what you heard Stephen Stepanek saying there, talking about what sounds like a very lax system of voter laws in New Hampshire?
Well, Steve's got a point about we do have very lenient voter registration laws here, but that's different than what the president and Stephen Miller claimed the other day, which is that hundreds or thousands of people are being bussed in from Massachusetts in some kind of vast conspiracy to commit fraud on an enormous scale. You can say that New Hampshire's laws about same-day registration are lax. I happen to agree with Stephen on that point. But that doesn't mean that casting a vote that way is illegal, and it certainly doesn't rise to the level of fraud. And that's what the president is suggesting.
Yeah, he is suggesting that, and he's suggesting even more than that, that he should have, if not for that lax system and the fraud that he alleges took place, that he would have won New Hampshire, that Maggie Hassan would have been defeated by Kelly Ayotte. I mean, is there any conceivable way to sort of make the link from that lax system to the kinds of numbers of fraudulent votes that would have been required to upset the outcome?
No, absolutely not. It's delusional. I mean, Senator Ayotte herself is not alleging that the election was robbed from her. It was a tightly contested election. She was defeated by only about 1,000 votes, and I regret that. I mean, I was a Kelly Ayotte supporter, and the election for president was close, too. Hillary Clinton carried New Hampshire by some 3,000 votes. But, you know, it's, of course, very telling that in the same time we had voters electing a Republican governor in New Hampshire, electing Republican majorities in the legislature. So, you know, if you're going to believe what the president and Stephen Miller are alleging, you would have to also think, what, these voters didn't also vote for other Democrats down the ballot? Is it not also possible that some people who are relatively newcomers to New Hampshire cast ballots for Trump and for Ayotte? It's just preposterous. And, you know, this idea of buses, I need to focus on that because that is the shibboleth brought up election cycle after election cycle. And yet somehow no one has produced a shred of evidence, no pictures of a bus at any of the some 400 precincts in New Hampshire, despite having, you know, hundreds of thousands of people voting, election workers at each one of these, people from both campaigns, Democrats and Republicans, at every polling place. Nobody snapped a picture of one of these alleged magic buses. And it's just preposterous. And for the president and his spokesman to be alleging this is really a disservice to voters. If they're trying to delegitimize an election, which he won. It's just crazy.
Is that your biggest concern about this, Fergus Cullen, that continuing to make allegations that there was widespread voter fraud delegitimizes the entire system?
Well, you know, if people can be misled or believe conspiracy theories about something as relatively unimportant as whether, you know, some votes were cast improperly in a state like New Hampshire, you know, what other conspiracy theories and what other delusions might they also entertain about things that are far more significant? That, I think, is the bigger concern to me.
Yeah. We heard Stephen Stefanik, though, talking about those voter affidavits. I mean, does the fact that a number of these affidavits bounce back, essentially aren't linked to a real address, does it lend some credence to this idea that there are at least some voters who are abusing the system, in your view?
Oh, well, there's a difference between abuse and breaking the law. And people have a right to vote. They only get to cast one. So if somebody were to vote in, say, two different communities or in two different states on the same day, that would be a problem, and they would almost certainly be caught and face significant penalties for that. Again, part of what the president is alleging here is that lots of people were willing to take that risk and face those kinds of consequences for the purpose of casting a ballot. You know, and Stephen Miller the other day said that anyone who's worked in New Hampshire elections knows this to be going on. No, it's completely the opposite. Everyone who has really worked in New Hampshire elections knows that this doesn't happen, at least in terms of buses. We did have a case a couple of years ago where campaign workers happened to be working for Democrats, all listed as their address, the home of a Democratic state senator from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Her name is Martha Fuller Clark. She was hosting a bunch of campaign workers, and most of them just disappeared after the election. Okay, that's obviously a flaw in the law, you know, so fix the law. But that doesn't mean that they violated the law, and it certainly doesn't rise to the level of fraud.
All right. Well, that's Fergus Cullen, former chairman of the New Hampshire Republican Party and now principal of Fergus Cullen Communications. Fergus, always a pleasure to have you. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Anthony.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, should child care be a public right? And what would that look like? Stick with us. We're going to take your calls. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Many schools across the state are closed today because of the latest winter storm. That meant another snow day for kids and for many parents, a scramble for childcare. From handing the kids off to a friend or family member, or working from home, or just skipping work altogether. Either way, it's the latest reminder about the challenge and cost of daycare, whether or not there's a winter storm. According to the think tank New America and Care.com, families in Massachusetts pay an average of $1,100 a month for full-time daycare. That's about a third of a median household income, one-third. So it's a big challenge for a lot of families. So if K-12 education is a public right, why not daycare, as it is in many European countries? Joanna Weiss, contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion blog, wrote about this in the Boston Globe yesterday. Her piece is headlined, "Is Daycare Impossible? Why Individual Families Shouldn't Bear the Burden of Childcare Costs?" And she joins us now. And Joanna, good to have you. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we'd love to get you into this conversation. How do you juggle daycare? Does it stretch your family budget? Is it time for universal government-subsidized daycare for Massachusetts, for the nation? We'd love to hear your take on this, your personal story. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So, Joanna, I wanted to start a little bit by just describing the daycare landscape and what it looks like. First of all, cost. We mentioned $1,100 a month on average in Massachusetts. That sounds like a huge chunk for many families to take on. Put that challenge in perspective for us.
It absolutely is. And it's, you know, on average in the nation, it's about $800 per month for that full-time center-based child care. And, you know, for a lot of families, that is, it's akin to having a second mortgage, and it's something that there are no loans. Like, you could get a loan to help you with college education. You can't really get a subsidized loan to help you with this. It's just something families are absolutely on their own. And at the same time, childcare workers are, in many cases, living in poverty or needing public assistance, because tuition alone can't really, you know, when you think about the ratios of teachers to students and the very razor-thin margins that childcare centers operate under, childcare professionals aren't making a lot of money off of this either. It's really an impossible economic situation.
Yeah, I think if I'm recalling the figure from your article, I mean, some of them are making, what, $9 or $10 an hour?
Median wage is $9.77 an hour.
Yeah, that's astounding. And then there's the question of how this system is organized, or maybe a better way to say it, how this system is not organized. I mean, what kind of challenge does this pose for families in terms of trying to find reliable, safe, good daycare nearby, local? I mean, it's all over the map, isn't it?
Well, once again, you're absolutely on your own with this. People cobble together a little bit of help from family if family's in town, but in many cases, you're searching your options for full-time care that can accommodate a parent's hours and also a commute. You know, there are in-home options and there are center-based options, and there are some wonderful ones out there, but it's an absolute challenge to find the right one that fits your lifestyle and then to pay for it.
Joanna Weiss, stand by. I want to bring in Barbara Beatty. I know you spoke to her, quoted her quite extensively in your piece. She's the professor of education and chair of education of the education department at Wellesley College and the author of Preschool Education in America. Barbara Beatty, thanks for joining us. We're very grateful.
And thank you for having me on the program.
So there's some interesting history that I wanted to start with you about, and that is that Congress had actually passed legislation for a kind of universal daycare a while back, but we clearly don't have it today. What happened?
Well, what happened was that in 1971, Walter Mondale, who later ran for president, as you know, and was beaten by Reagan, and John Brademas, so a senator and a congressman, created the Comprehensive Child Development Act, and it passed Congress, so both houses. And what it included was all kinds of developmentally informed services for young children and families, including universal child care, health kinds of issues. I mean, it was really a Comprehensive Child Development Act. So we had it. There it was.
Both parties came together, both houses of Congress. It was passed. And what happened? President Nixon didn't like it.
It went to President Nixon's desk, exactly, and he vetoed it. And so you can think of this as being the highlight in the idea of there being a public responsibility for helping young children and families. He vetoed it, and the reason why he vetoed it is really important to hear. He vetoed this, it was called Legislative Framework for Universalization of Child Development Services, and here's the reason. Because it would commit the vast authority of the national government to the side of communal approaches to child rearing over against the family-centered approach.
Hmm.
So what do you think of when you hear that?
I'm thinking of this idea that Joanna raised in her piece. She put it this way, that there's this idea out there that K-12 education is a job best done by professionals, but taking care of small children is a job best done by parents, which in most cases probably means mothers. I mean,
right.
is it this old idea that I guess killed it?
And I think it's important to frame this as a historian. So this was still the period of Cold War ideology.
I see.
So when you hear communal approaches,
aha,
you should hear communism.
I see.
But the other irony here, and I think this is not an irony, I think it has something to do with it. Do you know what else was passed in 1972? So right after the Nixon veto?
What's that?
Title IX.
Ah, okay.
Title IX, which is the U.S. Education Amendment that gives all sorts of rights to women, right?
Yeah.
Title IX.
Very interesting.
So this is at the peak of, or at the beginning, when feminism is starting to get real public support, but sort of toward the end, this Cold War era ideology.
Well, Barbara and I have talked extensively about the idea of this public versus private divide, and when does the public responsibility take over, and when in our culture do we think of things belonging in the private sphere? And that gets caught up in, you know, ideas about gender, ideas about home life that are a bit outdated, given especially, you know, in today's economics, the majority of families now are either headed by two working parents or by a single parent. So we're talking about outdated ideas, and yet we really have a hard time as a society shaking that idea about the private sphere for young kids.
All right. Listen, listeners, you can join this conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the question, is it time for publicly funded child care in the same way that K-12 education is publicly funded and a right? Let's take a couple of calls. Brooks is calling from Newton. Brooks, I assume no relation to me, but what's on your mind?
Yeah, I'd just like to weigh in on this. You know, I think we're confusing in this country between a right and a privilege. And in my opinion, having children is a privilege, not a right. If you're going to have children, you should be prepared to put the financial responsibility and burden of having those children. That's not something that other people should be burdened with.
Brooks, I really appreciate you putting that idea on the table. Barbara, let me come to you and respond to Brooks, if you will, because, I mean, I guess my question would be K-12 education is certainly regarded as a right because in many ways it serves broader society, right?
Absolutely. And I think one of the divides, another way of looking at this divide, is between other people's children and everybody's children. So the private child and the public responsibility for all children. And one way, I think a way to understand this is to look at how hard it was for us to bring one more year of life, five-year-olds, into the public sphere. Because we think children should be able to go to kindergarten, don't we?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think that schools should provide kindergarten.
But it wasn't always there, you're saying, of course.
It wasn't always there. And
right.
It's still usually voluntary, not compulsory. But it wasn't there. And if we look at how it was that we got another year of life into the public sphere, and I would argue that it's in a kind of special place, that it's a transition zone where children come out of the private family into the public sphere. And I'm sure parents feel that. I mean, the first time you drop your child off in kindergarten.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Terry is calling from Newton. Hi, Terry. You're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi. Thank you. So I just wanted to make a comment on the idea of a right to child care and having universal child care. I think different families have vastly different needs in terms of what they need for child care. I'm a grandmother. I raise two children working full time, and I have two grandchildren. And I think that the financial problem could be easily solved by, first of all, making all your child care payments 100% tax deductible, which they are not, and which actually can put a lot of burden on families. But if a business can deduct their secretary as a family, you should be able to deduct the full cost of your child care. And in certain income levels, I think there should be a tax credit or a rebate from the government on your taxes. You get money back in order to be able to pay for the child care. I think the idea of having a universal system would might satisfy a few people, but different people, different families have different needs. And I'm all for child care, and I'm all for not placing a burden on young families with lower income.
Well, Terry, you've put some proposals on the table, and that's sort of where I wanted to move this conversation next. And Joanna, I'll go to you for this. Barbara, too, by all means, chime in. As we know, what's being talked about, Ivanka Trump proposed a government benefit to help pay for daycare. So here's a political ad that was released in September before the election. This is Ivanka Trump talking about her father, Donald Trump.
My father will change outdated labor laws so that they support women and American families. He will provide tax credits for childcare, paid maternity leave, and dependent care savings accounts. This will allow women to support their families and further their careers.
And Joanna, of course, at the Republican National Convention, Ivanka Trump talked about this. So how would that work? And by the way, thanks to Terry, who was talking about tax credits in the same way that Ivanka Trump was there. How would that plan work?
Yeah, you know, and it's worth noting, by the way, that this presidential campaign was the first one in which both candidates from both parties talked about child care as an issue. So we're making some progress, at least in awareness on this issue. And yeah, I don't think that anyone is actually talking about subsidizing, creating a new school system of child care for everyone. It's a logistical and cost question that feels a little insurmountable at this point. What everyone's talking about in terms of actual policy proposals are things like dependent care savings accounts, earned income tax credits, things that are going to help families around the margins. And I think that I think it's realistic or possible that we can start to have some bipartisan conversations about that if the Trump administration is in fact actually on board.
Yeah. What do you think, Barbara? Yeah, go ahead.
I also think that we're moving toward changing how we think about young children. So with so many mothers of young children, I think, Joanna, you said it's 64% of children under six, but also we're starting to see now more the idea that young children, it's what I call, it's play learning, play-based learning, but that young children are learning a great deal before they even start kindergarten, and that we need to pay attention to the environments and the enrichment and the kinds of provision for play-based learning that we provide for all children. So there's this other divide between child care and preschool education that I'd like to mention that we need to bridge, because we think of when we say child care, and Joanna and your callers were saying this, who do we think of as the client? We think of the client as the mother. But when we say preschool education, we think of the client as the child. And I'm going to argue that we need to bridge that divide as well and start thinking about early childhood care and education as being something that's good for individual children, private families, and for all of us.
Although I do also want to bring up the idea that, I mean, Ivanka Trump's policy goal has a lot to do with labor participation for women, for mothers, and I think that's an important piece of the argument as well. We're taking care of children, but we're also allowing women to help their families to be independent in case of all kinds of contingencies that could happen in their lives. We're with child care assistance, we'd be helping people get education to better their family's economic status. So we're really talking about a policy that could help whole families.
See, this is really interesting because you raise this in the piece, Joanne, and I'm sure you know this history better than anyone, Barbara, and that is, I think you made the point, Joanna, that there have been times in our history when we had some subsidized child care, essentially, and it was when we wanted to get women into the workforce, right?
It was a little more targeted, right? But it, you know, and it was times like the Depression where there were child care centers that were as much for the benefit of women working and helping their families as for the children. It was during World War II when you had Rosie the Riveter working on the base building the ships and there was child care provided for them. So, yes, there are all kinds of social reasons. In European countries, there are a couple of countries that have quite explicitly subsidized child care in part because they wanted to boost fertility rates among young women. If it's easier to have children, more women will have kids.
And I want to add to that, because after Truman did away with the funding for the child care centers after World War II, and these centers were wonderful. I mean, they were 24/7. You could pick up meals, everything. What happened is that actually some states, California, you're not surprised, some states and some cities decided that this was so important that they were going to continue it. So I think where we need to look, where the action is in terms of universalizing responsibilities for children and helping families, it's at the state and local level.
Hmm. Let's go to Cynthia, who's calling from Providence with another question. Cynthia, you're on the air.
Thanks so much for taking my call. I really would beseech your guests to address the question that was brought up earlier by the gentleman caller that brought up the point between privilege and right. And again, I would like the ladies to address it. It was not addressed. And I truly feel it's a taboo that needs to be broken. We need to start talking about this issue.
All right, Cynthia. So that was Brooks who called, and Joanna and Barbara. And if you recall, the question was sort of, the distinction. If you bring kids into the world, that's a privilege. And that has to be distinguished between that you deserve a right to have that kid in subsidized daycare.
It's something that's an argument that I've heard so many times. I've been writing about child care and child and family issues for so many years, and someone always makes that precise comment, if you can't afford to have kids, then don't. And I would say we make decisions as a society about what we're going to subsidize and who we're going to support on so many different levels. I mean, you mentioned K-12 education. We've collectively agree that that's worth subsidizing. You can talk about Medicare. You can talk about Medicaid. You can talk about other people's vacation homes through FEMA. We're helping to support other people's vacation homes when they're damaged by storms and public taxpayer money goes to fixing those.
How about middle-class mortgages, for example?
That too.
Yeah.
Well, and also, there's so much research showing that when we help all children in this way, it helps all of society. It pays off. There's Nobel Prize winner Jim Heckman's research on how much it pays off to help children this way. So this is not something that's just about a privilege. It's about how the children that are going to be in our society, our future, how this will help all of us and them.
Well, as you mentioned so well in your piece, Joanna, we've got a ways to go, but clearly we're talking about it. We've been talking to Barbara Beatty. She's professor of education and chair of education department at Wellesley College, author of Preschool Education in America. Barbara, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Joanna Weiss is a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Opinion and Ideas blog, and she wrote a Boston Globe piece, which you can link to at radioboston.org, Is Daycare Impossible? Joanna Weiss, thanks so much for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Michael Anthony of Bridgeport, Massachusetts, served 12 months in Iraq as an Army medic. He was 21 when he returned to the States, happy to be home. But within a couple of weeks, he was in trouble. He was high on Vicodin, drunk, and picking a fight with a very large Hell's Angel. Anthony says he never felt more alive than when he was working at a combat support hospital. But back home, he felt hollow, without purpose, filled with rage, addicted to painkillers, and suicidal. Then, on a drunken whim, Anthony signed up for a 3-day seminar on how to attract women which led to a journey of self-discovery and ultimately salvation. Michael Anthony writes about this with a mix of candor and humor in his new memoir, Civilianized, and he joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So this is your second memoir. The first was Mass Casualties. It looked at your deployment, your deployment in Iraq. Tell me a little bit about that. It was 12 months. What was it like?
Yeah, so my deployment to Iraq was, I mean, it was interesting. You know, it's not your typical, you know, wartime experience that you might, you know, vision from a movie or a TV show. It was a combat support hospital, and we were a reserve unit from Massachusetts. So we weren't those active duty people. So we were a lot more lax and, I guess, liberal in our military bearing, and it definitely showed through in some of the experiences that we had overseas.
Such as?
I guess I would just say some of that lack of military bearing. You know, there is, you know, behind-the-scenes stories, you know, what I love to write about is the human aspect of war. Mm-hmm. You know, those real people at war, not just those one-dimensional, idealized, romanticized versions. So, I mean, an example would be, you know, you're in war and there's a mortar attack and the bombs are falling and you go to your hospital and you save a bunch of lives, right? But then afterwards, over at the barracks, there's like an orgy that happens or like a gangbang that happens. And that there's just that real human aspect of war that happens. You know, these are people at war and there's that, you know, that dark aspect, I guess,
dark
that happens behind the scenes.
That people get involved with. So you return home, you're 21 years old. What was your, I have to assume you were happy about the idea of coming home. What was your plan?
Yeah, I mean, coming back from war, while you're overseas at war, you build up being back home. You build up everything that you're going to do when you get back home, everyone you're going to see, and you just get this idealized version. But then you come back home, and it just hits you. You know, mm-hmm. when you're thinking of everything back home and the people back home, you think everyone's just perfect. Even the people you hated are, you know, you romanticize them. Oh, they weren't that bad after all. But then you come back home, and you see, you know, sometimes you see a society that, you know, they don't even realize we were still at war overseas, or they don't care.
Yeah.
And you're coming back home to that. Or, you know, we came back home to a recession. So you're coming back home and there's no jobs available. And there's partisan politics. People care more about the Kardashians than, you know, Kandahar.
And I guess there has to be an issue of sort of personal purpose as well. I mean, right, when you're in a war zone, when you're saving lives, when literally the actions you're taking every day are life and death, I mean, they can really matter. There must be a part of you that sort of misses that sense of dramatic purpose.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. You know, a lot of veterans, when they come back home, you know, there's this very high suicide rates for veterans right now. They estimate between 20 and 22 veterans kill themselves every day in the United States. And I think a lot of it does have to do with they come back home and they miss that sense of purpose, that sense of adrenaline. Overseas, when you're in war, you know, war demands 100% of a person's everything, you know, their spirit, their soul. You need to give 100%. And you can go, you realize how tough a human spirit is. You can go days with, you know, near a thing to eat, you know, days, weeks without, you know, just 1 or 2 hours of sleep a night. And you push yourself to this maximum for this purpose, to this mission. And you come back home and civilian life just doesn't, you know, call that from you. You know, right. It doesn't call you to be 100% of the time. Right. It doesn't call to be 100% of you. You could just be some poor schlop working 40 hours a week, giving, you know, 30% of yourself, and you're making a nice little income for yourself, a nice little middle-class life. You know, civilian life just doesn't call you to be that 100% person, that, you know, realized person.
Right. So in your case, very soon after you get back, as you write, you're addicted to painkillers, you're drinking, you're filled with anger, you say you feel hollow. And at a certain point, there's this scene where you're picking a fight with a Hell's Angel who is about 3 times your size. First of all, explain that. That seems like a situation that anyone interested in self-preservation wouldn't want to get into.
Yeah, I guess you just come back from this, you know, war, and you're just in that head zone of, you know, this guy doesn't know who I am. You know, he doesn't know what I've been through. And there was just this Hell's Angel walking around like he owns the world. And I'm just this young back from the war walking around like I own the world. And then we just kind of collided. These two guys thinking they own the world kind of just collide. And that's what happened there.
Right. And what did it tell you? I mean, as you sort of thought about it afterwards, what did it make you think?
Well, I mean, it didn't tell me anything right away. I don't think any thoughts or realization probably didn't come until months and months and months later. But at the time, I was just kind of looking forward to a fight, I guess.
Yeah, right. Now, things got pretty bleak for you. At one point, you call the Veterans Administration suicide hotline a couple of times, and you note in the book that the hotline receives an average of 50,000 calls a year since it opened in 2007. Were they able to help you in any way?
I don't think at that time they were able to help me. I think a lot of these organizations, and you know, they have good intentions, but I mean, there's pretty much scripts that they have to follow, and sometimes, I mean, I guess there's that one aspect of just talking about things helps you, but another aspect, there is that kind of script that they have to follow, and I don't know. I don't think it really gets to the heart of the issue. I think a lot of veterans, you know, it helps when they talk to other veterans, somebody who kind of gets it right off the bat. When you're talking to somebody and they're there to help, but they haven't had those experiences, they're just there to kind of talk about things. And one of the things that I have seen helped a lot of veterans is when it's those same conversations, but instead of with, you know, this trained suicide operator, it's just that same conversation with the veteran. And yeah, it goes a lot further when they can, you know, already have that connection.
All right. So tell us what happened. You at a certain point, you're feeling pretty desperate. You give yourself a 3-month deadline, and this is a pretty serious deadline, right? You're thinking, if I can't sort of get things sorted out, I'm going to do what in 3 months?
Yeah. So I guess I just gave myself this arbitrary deadline. You know, if I don't feel better in 3 months, I'm just gonna kill myself. You know, I'm just gonna end it. And I came back from the Iraq War with, you know, over $50,000 in the bank because I didn't spend any money. I did employment. You know, war actually pays pretty well even if you're a lowly, you know, soldier. So I came back with all this money, and I just had this idea, like, I'm just gonna spend it and see if after these couple of months, you know, there's anything, you know, that happens inside that makes me want to, you know, keep going on. So that's where I started taking these dating courses that, you know, a couple $1,000, you learn how to talk to girls. And I was just a shy, nerdy guy, you know, thinking, you know, of course, this 21-year-old's going to think, oh, this is what's going to save me, you know, learning how to talk to girls and get laid.
Okay, so say a little bit more about these classes. How are they set up? They sound sort of super awkward, I got to say.
No, they are super awkward. I mean, so they're called pickup artist classes. Okay. So they're actually pretty big out in the world. They're called pickup artist classes. And, you know, they promise if you come to these classes, it's a week-long course, costs a couple $1,000. They'll teach you how to talk to girls. And some of them really, you know, there's different methodologies they teach you. There's like the direct method they teach you where you just kind of walk up like you're the cock of the walk and just, you know, say directly what you're looking for. And there's like the indirect method where it's like you say these kind of lines and you slowly build up attraction, you build up a connection, and then you do all these little pseudo-psychological tricks, and that'll get you.
So the good news in reading this book is you managed to find your way out of this depression. How did these courses help you do that?
I don't know if the courses helped me. I mean, they helped me get laid. I don't know if they helped me okay, internally.
Remember,
for anything.
Family program.
Right.
Okay, there we go.
Yeah. Things, you know, these things lead to families. So, yeah. But, you know, they helped me with that aspect. They didn't help me with anything internally. I think the biggest thing that helped me towards the end was when I actually started writing. And writing gave me that sense of purpose and mission, you know, something greater than myself, to actually write a true war story, something that would help veterans. And, you know, what we talked about just a couple of minutes ago, you lose that sense of purpose and mission when you come back from the war. And when I found the aspect of writing, you know, something to actually work towards and have a mission and purpose, something that was greater than myself, that helped dig me out of this hole pretty much, where I just said, okay, this is something to focus on rather than all these bad thoughts and memories and just, you know, looking to chase, you know, just girls, you know, doing something greater than myself gave me that sense of purpose.
You know, this question of how to help veterans, it's such a sort of universal subject. I spent a lot of time over the last year and a half covering a presidential campaign. I never went to a presidential campaign event where veterans weren't honored, where veterans weren't saluted, where all of whoever the candidate was said, we're going to do more to help the veterans. But in a way, the words rang hollow to me because it almost sounded like a habit. I mean, I guess this is sort of leading to the question, what should be done? I mean, as a veteran, what would you really like to see happen in a way that helps veterans?
Well, one of my favorite veteran charities is an organization called Mission Continues, and they're actually a charity that they help veterans by asking veterans to give back. So a lot of these charities out there, they kind of put those kid gloves on for veterans, like, oh, come to us and we'll take you on a kayaking trip, or come to us and we'll give you this therapy. This Mission Continues, they actually go out there and say, no, listen, we're not going to give you anything. We want you veterans to come here and volunteer your time to make your community better. And it's called Mission Continues because it goes to give those veterans, like, listen, you gave everything you had over to war, but you're not done. All right, we have more for you to do. And that actually has helped a lot of veterans to get out there and just give back to their community. And that has actually turned a lot of veterans around to go get back in that zone of being a giver instead of coming home and being a taker or not having that sense of purpose or mission. So Mission Continues is definitely one of my favorite veteran charities. Like I said, it just asks veterans to give more of themselves. And that somehow just calls forth those veterans to, just like, you know, we talked about earlier, get themselves together and have that purpose and sense of mission again.
Well, Michael Anthony of Bridgeport, Mass., he's the author of Civilianized, A Young Veteran's Memoir. Michael Anthony, a real pleasure having you. Thanks for coming in and talking about your experience.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For the second year in a row, the Boston Symphony Orchestra is celebrating a Grammy win, this time for Under Stalin's Shadow, part of a series of Shostakovich symphonies. You're hearing the music behind us right now. Another local artist who won a Grammy last night, Laurie McKenna. She won for Best Country Music Song. To talk about that and more, let's turn to Tim Riley, music critic and professor of journalism at Emerson College. And Tim, always good to see you.
Good to see you, Anthony.
Thanks for coming in. So let's talk about the BSO and let's start by listening to music director Andrus Nelson's talking about this wonderful recording.
When we capture recordings, of course, we want to be as close as possible to the live concert. And, of course, it's a huge, huge thanks, and it's absolutely a teamwork.
So that's Andrus Nelson's. Tim, tell us something about Andrus Nelson's, this recording, and what this Grammy means to the BSO.
Well, you know, it's a great project, and he really could not have picked a better large-scale project to kick off his debut with the BSO in terms of recording, because it's the way the rest of the world is going to get to hear his partnership with the BSO musicians. And he clearly has a very strong affinity with the Shostakovich material. Last year's Shostakovich's 10th recording that I listened to was absolutely stunning. I mean, it was one of the great orchestral recordings I have ever heard. And this year's, they released three new symphonies in that series, and we just listened to an excerpt from the fifth, which is probably the best-known Shostakovich recording. And I promise you, if you know the fifth, you will revel in this recording of it. It is absolutely an astonishing reimagining of how Shostakovich sounds and what his music means. I mean, I think he's really, in terms of like getting a new music director and kicking off a recording project, you couldn't ask for a better series.
All right. Well, let's turn from Shostakovich to pop music and some of the Grammy Awards there. Adele upset a heavy favorite Beyoncé and took home Album of the Year, but she didn't have the strongest performance last night. Here's a bit from her tribute to the late George Michael, which required her to stop and restart. She had to take a mulligan. Here we go.
I know it's live TV. I'm sorry. I need to start again. I can't do it again like last year. I'm sorry for swearing and I'm sorry for starting again. Can we please start it again? I'm sorry. I can't mess this up for him. I'm sorry. I can't. I'm sorry for swearing. I'm really sorry.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that moment. She got it together for take two, we have to say. But what do you think? That's a sort of an unusual moment for
right.
a Grammy program.
Well, you know what they say. If you can fake sincerity, then you've really got it made, right? So this is kind of turning into a shtick for her. I don't want to be cynical. I know. I think that's one of the things that's appealing about Adele is that she really is quite down to earth, right? She's a diva, right, when she sings. But when she talks outside of the recordings, when she does interviews, she is very down to earth, very funny. She does not take herself seriously. And that's really a winning formula for a diva, because you don't want to be Barbra Streisand. You don't want to be Kiss My Ring, I'm the greatest of all time. And,
okay.
Right? So I'm happy with, you know, I think Adele is very deserving and a really interesting talent, and she killed it last night.
All right, let's talk about another one. Here's Beyoncé, who had an absolutely perfect performance, including this number, Love Drought. Beyoncé there with Love Drought. Now, she was a favorite for album, record, or song of the year, but she lost all three categories to Adele. What do you think?
Well, so this brings up a larger problem with the Grammys. Can anyone please explain to me the difference between record of the year and album of the year.
Oh yes, I can.
And
of course
song
I can.
Of the year.
No, I can't. I'm sorry.
I know. I mean, so why do they have these? So yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't think she should have lost on all three counts, but there's obviously like just too much overlap and not enough definition. And what do we mean when we say record of the year, really? And so you have to sort of agree with Adele. Yeah, you know, Beyonce maybe, you know, should, I mean, Beyonce should have won at least one of those things. But Beyonce's really in an interesting position here. She's performing 5 months pregnant with twins in her belly. And nobody wants to see her tipping back in the chair the way she did. And, you know, it's a really scary moment. Now, she's going to headline Coachella next month, 6 months pregnant with twins. This is really precarious for a big performer. And I'm really curious how it's going to come off. You know, there's nothing more demonized in our society than a bad mother, and she's right. She's creeping right up to that edge.
Really interesting. Okay, Tim, we're almost out of time, and yeah. I want to talk to you about Laurie McKenna, another local artist. She won a Grammy last night, this time for Best Country Song. She wrote Tim McGraw's Humble and Kind. We'll listen to just a few seconds of this. I know you got me. So McKenna won a Grammy last year. Tell us a little about this local writer.
Well, no, she's terrific. She's from Stoughton. She has five kids. She's worked for years. Critics really love her, and she's great. Everyone knows she needs to win for her own singing. She's won for Best Song 2 years in a row now. It'll really be a triumph when the Grammys give her an award for one of her own records.
All right. That's Tim Riley talking about last night's Grammy Awards. Tim is a professor at Emerson College and a music critic. Tim, always great to have you. Thanks so much for coming
Thanks, Anthony.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR 90.9, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.